You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Hey, everybody. We got a great one today because Andy Slavitt, who's been on this podcast more than any other guest. And you want to know why? Because he has stuff interesting to say, unlike my other guests. So this is a good one for a change, except the other times Andy's been on. That's what I'm saying. And Andy has written a book called Preventable. And it's about, what's it about? Oh, yes, the coronavirus and the pandemic and all the stuff that was preventable if this has been handled properly. And it's pretty chilling reading the book. I recommend it. It gives you a blow-by-blow and has a lot of stories, and I don't want to ruin any of them for you because some of these are just stunning, including admissions by people like Jared Kushner that, we're doing this because so if it screws up, then we don't have to take blame. That's why we're giving it to the states. I mean, those of you who've listened know who Andy is. He had two tasks, big ones, in the Obama administration. One, he's the guy that fixed the website for the Affordable Care Act. It launched October 1 and went down October 1 of 2013. And Andy came from Minnesota, where he's working at United Health, Andy's friend, and he fixed it in 5 weeks. And I think he saved the Affordable Care Act, and I think he saved the Obama presidency. He won't say that, but I will. Then he became the head of CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That is a $1 trillion organization. They spend $1 trillion every year, Medicare and Medicaid, and he supervises a lot of other stuff too in that role. So a man who knows healthcare, not a doctor, not a scientist, but a guy who's like an executive who knows how to get things done. And as soon as COVID hit, that's what he did. And he did that not in the government, but he interacted a lot with the Trump people to try to help. They didn't take his advice a lot, as you can imagine. He started hashtag stay at home, getting people to stay at home, which we needed to do. We just needed to do that. And that stopped the spread from escalating until, of course, Trump and the Southern governors and everybody started reopening everything. Andy also, for the first 4 months of the Biden administration, was a senior advisor to the coronavirus task force, worked out of the White House. And he left it a couple weeks ago. Now he has this book coming out, and it really is kind of a must read to understand really how this could have been done better. But it isn't all Trump, but boy. It's a pretty chilling book, and this is a pretty chilling interview. So I'm going to get to it right away because this is it's a really good one for a change. When we come back, I'll be talking to Andy Slavitt. you cover beginning to end, not beginning to end, because it hasn't ended yet. And I want to ask you about the Delta variant and where we are right now. So let's start there. Where are we right now?
As a country, we are in a place that has undergone, I think, a enormous transformation. Maybe the biggest transformation you could imagine a country going through in 5 months, from a place where COVID was basically dictated everything we did, killing thousands of people a day, and was a state of emergency, to something which I would call a manageable threat. I mean, a manageable challenge, maybe that's better said, a manageable challenge. And we have lots of manageable challenges in our life, Al. Like, this is just one of a longer list. But it's no longer in a place where it upends society. And if you've been vaccinated, you are extremely well protected. And so I know that that's a big adjustment for people to hear, because we've been living with a certain amount of fear the last year. But if you've been vaccinated, if you've been double vaccinated with the mRNA vaccines in particular, you largely have the opportunity to get your life back now and the things that you lost during the pandemic. So we're in a much, much, much better place.
And what we're hearing is that the Delta variant spreads easier, right? It's more infectious than the other variants. And the question to me is, do the vaccines take care of it?
Here's an odd statement. It is actually a little bit to our benefit, assuming you've been vaccinated, that this Delta variant spreads faster. And here's why. Because the vaccines work on it, it outcompetes the variants that are more problematic. So there is actually a beta variant, the one that first appeared in South Africa, that the vaccines had a little more trouble with. But the beta variant hasn't had an opportunity to grow, because the faster growing variants are the ones like Alpha and now Delta, that are ones that also the vaccine works on well. So in some ways, it's sort of like it's an ally in destroying the more problematic variants. So far, we are in a really fortunate position if we've been vaccinated. If you haven't been vaccinated, it's a completely different story.
Okay, then let's just talk about that. When I'm old enough to remember polio, and I'm old enough to have gotten the polio vaccine. We all just took the polio vaccine, and now there's no polio. And to me, it was, okay, the polio vaccine is available. Let's go get it. So, my parents go down there and to school and take the polio vaccine because we don't want you to get polio. And I went, boy, yeah, I think I know what that is. No, I don't want to get it. And we just got rid of polio. And any doctor you talk to never seen polio now. And they sometimes treat people who had polio. Some people who are older, and that's not pretty. And that can come back. But my God, what changed? What was this? And in my mind, it's Trump. And then we're going to spend a lot of time on Trump. And the picture you paint here is of someone who completely abdicated all responsibility whatsoever.
Well, you got me thinking. You're talking about polio. People who lived through that, adults who lived through that, it was exactly as you described earlier, which is imagine robbing the life and joy out of kids. Because everyone knows the most famous person with polio was FDR, but he was an exception. Most people who got polio were kids, and they couldn't play. I mean, they just basically obviously destroyed their ability to have a life. But we were a more unified country. We trusted science. We looked out for one another, I should say, with obvious exceptions. Then, there was a common good. The gap between rich and poor was not as wide as it is now. All of those things changing, I think, have some incremental impact on our ability and willingness to do something that feels like it's part of a patriotic duty or a common cause. And putting aside Trump completely, the idea of doing something like taking a vaccine is now almost entirely evaluated through the lens of what's good for me. And it turns out that for people over 65, it clearly was something that's good for them. In terms of people who are over 40, it was clearly something that was good for them. From people 18 to 25, they don't see it. And they don't see a reason.
But the weird part is seeing a reason not to. And of course, that is the disinformation, which is so pernicious. You know, you write about Trump and you, we know now that he knew about it. We know from Woodward that he knew what it was, while he at the same time he was saying we have it completely under control. And my I feel like Trump would have won re-election, which would have been a disaster of another sort, if he had handled this correctly, if he had handled it right.
I completely agree with you. So, like, my sense of things is, like, first of all, let's stipulate this. Pandemics are massive challenges, and it's really hard to manage a pandemic, you know, flawlessly, particularly if it's a novel virus and you've never seen it before and you don't really know what's going to happen. And there's plenty of innocent or well-meaning mistakes that all of which I think are forgivable.
In the book, you basically, one of the chilling things is he gives all the responsibility to the states, essentially. And I compared this to, like, if after Pearl Harbor, FDR had said, you know, this is really Hawaii's problem, you know. But what's chilling to me is a conversation you have with Kushner. And I think this was on testing. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if they screw up, then it's their fault and it's not our fault. And it was like, he was like, you see, we're smart.
Right. Yeah. And look, it turned out to be the exact wrong thing to do, because I agree with what you said earlier, which is, if you, as I said, managing a pandemic is hard, but if you show a modicum of decency, empathy, and that you're really working on it, which, by the way, I think the vast majority of governors did, then you at least get a B, right? Maybe you don't get an A, but you get a B. And I think, to your point, people rally to politicians in times of crisis. And so he was probably served up on a platter an enormous political opportunity if he would have just done a few things that I think are unforgivable that he didn't do. Number one, in January, as soon as he knew that thousands of people were going to die from the coronavirus and it was coming here, he should have very just simply said, we have a problem. It's time for everybody to protect themselves. The fact that he didn't do that is something that I think will go down. It's take your Pearl Harbor thing. It's like imagine, you know, Pearl Harbor is attacked, and he says, no, it wasn't. It's not attacked. Nope. There's nothing going on here. And, you know, he had an ability in lesser situations to influence reality, or at least the perception of reality, by simply saying something wasn't the case. Gaslighting it, I guess, is what people call it.
Well, he said it was all under control, all that. He said that for quite a while. And remember when it was clear that it wasn't out of control anymore and lots of people were dying, where and he was asked about this at a press conference, and he said, well, I'm like a cheerleader. I wanted to be a cheerleader. And I'm going, what? That's like saying, like, the cheerleaders at a game cheer and then they take out AK-47s and fire it into the stands. I mean, that is just the dumbest fucking thing. And what it was about was he didn't want the stock market to go down tomorrow.
So this is where we learned it. What I learned that I reported in the book is he learned about this in January, goes to bed every night, presumably sleeping like a baby all during February. It's early March. Rudy Gobert, who's an NBA basketball player, gets COVID by horsing around, infects other people. Adam Silver suspends the NBA season.
And your son says he probably just saved a lot of lives.
He probably just saves a lot of lives, because what that triggers is the stock market then
starts. Your son comes off as a genius in this, by the way.
Yeah, sadly, he's smarter than his dad. So Trump is in the situation then where Wall Street traders call him after these two big days when the stock market takes a bath. And the only way he's persuaded to have a press conference to tell the public about this is because he thinks it's the only way to save the stock market. So what he does, and every one of the people that were involved in this next bit was a source of mine for the story, is he basically has a team arrange a press conference early in the week that will get the stock market back up by recruiting the CEOs of major drugstore companies and Google and others, and they make these commitments that they're going to open up drive-through testing sites across the country, that they're going to have a website to tell everybody where to get tested, and that they've got this thing well in hand. And so what happens next is they have this news conference. He has about five CEOs standing behind him. They leave the news conference, and the following happens. Number one, the stock market goes up dramatically. Number two, he then gives a gift. He gets the headlines of the newspaper that show the biggest rise in the stock market, signs them, Donald Trump, thank you for what you've done, gives them to the team that put this together. Number three, every single commitment made in that press conference was never followed up on. And number four, that day, Donald Trump decided that the pandemic was done as far as he was concerned.
Yeah, and that is, it's stupid. I mean, it's cruel. It's completely irresponsible, and that's why I was saying that he took no responsibility for anything during this.
Oh, right. Well, when Jared said to me that he believed that Trump would get credit for the country opening, and then when things got bad again and things had to close, that the governors would get the blame. My response was, first of all, that's a political strategy. It's not a public health strategy. Secondly, I believed it was the wrong thing, and I argued with him strenuously. And thirdly, it turned out not to be a smart political strategy, because in the end of the day, he couldn't avoid accountability.
But still, with the unbelievable disinformation coming from Fox, from talk radio, from Limbaugh while he's still alive, from Hannity, from everybody, from social media, that it was close. It was close. And he came close to stealing it. Closer than I think we know. First of all, he tried to steal it. And I think the storming the Capitol on January 6th, they came closer than we'll ever know to literally killing members of Congress. And now 75% or 80% or 85% of Republicans are Trump Republicans. We'll see how that plays out. But I know that all my former colleagues in the Senate and Republicans in the House, virtually all of them, are scared of this guy and scared of, they see, you know, Jeff Flake defected, boom, he's gone. It's remarkable. This guy's control of the party and what's happened to the Republican Party. But you do your best in this book to avoid making this partisan. You work with a lot of Republicans, former members of the Bush administration, the W administration, who join you in a number of things, including, I remember you've been on this podcast maybe 6, 7, 8 times when you were trying, you put together a plan for testing and then separating people and quarantining and isolating them, which other countries did, right? And other countries did it successfully. I mean, let's compare us with, you do this, Germany. I mean, sometimes you might going to go South Korea. Well, that's not really fair because, one, they had seen these kind of pandemics before, and also they're a more unified society than we are.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We can take that as an excuse. Or New Zealand, that's kind of small. I mean, I know what they did was all the right stuff. And Hong Kong, same thing. But Germany,
yeah,
Germany's big.
Germany A, they're ethnically diverse, much more than they've ever been. B, they are surrounded by other countries. They've had lots of borders, unlike us, who really, we have two borders. So that would make them more exposed.
And that's Mexico and Canada.
Mexico, Canada. Thanks. And so you don't have a lot of respect for your listeners' geographical knowledge.
No, I don't.
So Germany had about a middle of the road response, middle of the road set of circumstances, and they had about 25% of the per capita deaths than we had in the U.S. And I have to say this, that if the president had, number one, called this out when he saw it in January, number two, not fired and all of the scientists and prohibited every single scientist that wanted to put out a different narrative, then this is overblown. And number three, if he hadn't politicized masks, those three things alone, let alone doing a better job in testing and everything else, I think we would have been very close to Germany's numbers, which is hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths. It still would have been a tragedy. I mean, if we would have lost 200,000 people, this would still have been a tragedy.
But let's talk about testing for a second. And I read in your book, I mean, I knew that the CDC's first test was a failure, which is unusual. The World Health Organization had put out a test that we could have used, right? But we didn't. We chose, the CDC said, we always do our own tests. And there are all kinds of labs that offered to do it. And the FDA who decided, or the CDC who decided. Yeah. And in your book, it's very unclear who made this decision that no, we will not approve any test that's not developed by the CDC.
You're exactly right. The big mistake was, and it was by the FDA, who did not allow labs around the country to develop tests because we very quickly had to figure out where the virus was and contain it. Recall that South Korea had their first case on the same day we did. They let every lab in their country develop a test, and they quickly had enough tests to start to contain the virus. We didn't, but here's what's interesting, comes out in the book that wasn't part of, I think, anything else that had been previously reported, is Alex Azar, the guy who runs the Health and Human Services Department, was having a beef with the FDA. And so when he put together his task force, a beef for a completely different reason, and he's petty, he's a petty person. And when he was putting together his task force, he decided to leave off the FDA and CMS.
Crazy.
Right.
And CMS.
And CMS, who was in charge of, guess what, nursing home safety.
Mm-hmm. And you headed up CMS, so the audience should know that.
Yes, I headed up CMS under Obama. And
Barack Obama was president before Trump.
Right, right. You're doing a good job explaining these things to the audience.
I don't have a lot of respect for my audience.
I'm not skating past these things, assuming that people like just know that we border Mexico and that we had Barack Obama was a president. But
he's two presidents ago now. It's not, you know, Biden is the president now, so it gets confusing.
That's true.
Okay, now let's, Azar, let's make it clear for my audience who I don't respect that he's the head of HHS. Under HHS are these agents, these huge agencies, FDA, and important agencies, the CDC and CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And you talk to him, he doesn't know who made this decision, or he says he doesn't know who made this decision.
He claimed that the FDA made the decision without his knowledge. Now, the FDA claims that they believed, they had heard from Azar, that they were not to enlist labs around the country because it would violate President Trump's narrative that this whole thing was under control and blown out of proportion. And that if you got a whole bunch of labs saying that they were working on tests, it would go against that narrative. So we can decide, do we believe what Azar said or do we believe what the FDA said? But either way.
Or incompetence.
And I think Azar bears responsibility because FDA reports to him. He decided not to include them in the crisis planning. And if the FDA was left with if they watched TV, they would believe it was under control. So what do we need tests for? I mean, I'm being a little bit facetious here, But
yes,
the dysfunction, it turns out that there was
now who doesn't have respect for the audience? That was clearly facetious.
That respects the audience's intelligence to understand facetiousism.
I'm in the audience and they stop talking about me.
Right, exactly.
Interview the guy.
People have tuned this out. People have already tuned this out. But you know, it's like the dysfunction starts with Trump basically saying that this is the story and you're all going to stick to it, with Azar, who was in a bad place with Trump and a pleaser and trying to carry out orders, whatever those orders were. And so when those orders violated common sense, then things just didn't get done and they rolled downhill, which is not to say that the CDC didn't make a mistake on its own by having a bad test. They did. I want to be very clear about that. But the thing I know from leading two major crisis responses at the national level is you...
The other being the complete crashing of the Obamacare website, which is something that you fixed in 5 weeks and I think saved the ACA and the Obama presidency.
Yeah, so the thing I learned in managing major crises is you have to, if your plan requires you to be flawless and make zero mistakes, it's not a very good plan. You have to account for multiple paths out. So the most important mistake wasn't that the CDC messed up on their test. The reason you enlist hundreds of labs to build their own tests is precisely because someone's going to screw one of them up and you can't be single-threaded. If I were going to give it a war analogy, you need multiple paths out of the jungle in case the path you take is blocked off. You have to have multiple routes out.
And since you were in the Obama administration and head of CMS there, one of the things that has made me crazy over the last several years is, especially during this pandemic, is Trump saying, the Obama administration left the cupboard bare. Trump became president in 2017. If the cupboard was bare, I mean, he got rid of the pandemic office within the NSA. He took people out of China, CDC people. He took people all over the world, defunded CDC. He did a whole bunch of crappy stuff while he was there before the pandemic, but he had every opportunity to fill the cupboard if you're so concerned about the cupboard.
Right. Well, after SARS and Ebola, as you know, because you were in the Senate, the president and the Democrats proposed refilling the stockpile and the Republicans rejected it. And every year that was in a president's budget every year, the Republicans rejected it. And then when Trump came into office, he decided to cut funding for the stockpile by 10% every year. So this is sort of like why the businessman president thing is this sort of fallacy, is it's like, I'm a businessman and I know that we're wasting money on stuff that we've never had to use, like masks and ventilators and things that work, that sit in the strategic stockpile. So I'm gonna cut them because I'm a shrewd businessman. But of course, I don't have a clue what those things are for and what happens when we don't have them. And then, of course, his go-to move is to be like, oh, Obama left the cupboards bare. And like, honestly, I don't think he bothered to ask whether Obama, I mean, he lies freely. So it's not like he's like, I got to go check and see, can you find out what happened? Can I kind of twist the truth a little bit? He's like, oh, Obama left the cupboards bare. And, you know, I think the, you know, he's got a staff of people that were so used to him lying that, like, they'd get called on it on the news. They'd be like, well, you know, the president's, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, how the tap dancing that one had to do to serve in that administration and please Trump made it nearly impossible to imagine anything getting done.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't go to Deborah Birx and go, like, if I say that the cupboard was bare,
right,
would that be 100% true? Well, it depends what you mean. Okay. I mean, I, Speaking of Deborah Burks, she doesn't come off great in your book. Sometimes better than others, shall I say that. But I want to play something, and you referred to it, and this is what made me want to play it again. Peter has it lined up. This is her, and you'll, as soon as you hear me say what it is, it's the interview with Christian Broadcasting Network, in which she characterizes Trump's supervision of the pandemic.
He's been so attentive to the scientific literature and the details and the data. And I think his ability to analyze and integrate data that comes out of his long history in business has really been a real benefit during these discussions about medical issues. Because in the end, data is data, and he understands the importance of the granularity. And I think he's been really excited about finding the level of detail that we've been able to now bring over the last few weeks to really understand who's at the greatest risk for severe illness, who will have mild and less and asymptomatic disease, and really calling on every American to do that social distancing, because some people may not know they're actually infected and be unknowingly spreading the virus. And that all comes from the president seeing the data and then really directing these policies and these guidelines that go out to the American people.
Why? Would she say, here's a guy who is just looking at the granularity of the scientific data, and that has been a huge benefit to our work? Why would she say that? Was there a gun actually, literally, pointed at her head? I mean, how could you? It's one thing to sort of, well, the president is paying very close attention. You know, but this is why would she do this?
Yeah, I mean, probably the first time the words Trump, data, and granularity got used in the same paragraph. But I mentioned in the book that I had
Alan Weisselberg is more in the granularity of the data,
right? So I referenced in the book that I had a conversation with a well-known former Democratic senator who I know quite well about this very thing. I don't mention the senator by name in that conversation, but he asked a very similar question than the one you're asking now. And he, by the way, he looked a lot like you and sounded a lot like you. So we've had this conversation. And like your question was, you know, is she selling out or is she working the ref? And, you know, I have this, my interpretation is that she thought she was working the ref, and she believed at that point in time that he endorsed her plan. And her plan was to set up a whole bunch of gates that would be required for social distancing standards to be relaxed. And those gates had to do with very granular data. And she thought he endorsed her plan. And the day she announced her plan, the very next day, he went and tweeted, "Liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota," in reference to kind of armed Trump supporters that wanted to storm the governor's offices in both.
Because they wanted to open their states. They wanted to do the opposite of what right. she wanted to do.
They weren't ready for. And I have a scene in the book where the lawyer gets involved because he literally just violated his own rules. But she was naive. She thought she had persuaded the president to support her, and she thought she was shoring up that support by doing what everybody in the Trump administration did, which is get some tape out there of her praising the president for this brilliant action. Meanwhile, he was nodding, winking, laughing to his supporters, saying, of course I don't support this expert nonsense garbage. Now, but I will say this about Deborah Burks is, in her defense, people who didn't like Deborah Burks hadn't yet met Scott Atlas.
Well, what a compliment.
Yeah.
What a compliment. Scott Atlas, of course, really basically took her job, right?
Mm-hmm.
And came in, and of course, he is a doctor. He is a medical doctor, a radiologist, right?
Yes.
And if I, like, if if there's a question whether my arm was broken, for example, I would trust him.
Well, look, I would say this. Everybody in the book, I tried to write in a way that was true to life. You know, Jared Kushner, not as a caricature, but, you know, actual interactions. But I will say the one character, the one person in the book that is not portrayed as, like, in a way you think of as a real human being with flaws and et cetera, is Atlas. And I'll tell you why. I was part of a conversation that Reince Priebus was having back in the spring. And this is when all of the, you know, the pointy-headed experts were saying, you know, gee, this is really bad. People are going to die. And Trump was saying, no, it's not. This is, you guys are over, this is way overblown. And Priebus said, what the White House has to do next, and I was just at the White House this week, is they're going to go find our own experts, and we're going to play to the media's penchant for both sidesism. And we're going to find someone with a really impressive degree that's an epidemiologist or that comes from Harvard or Stanford. So I got on Twitter, and in a kind of a mocking way, I did like a, hey, there's a job opening and a great opportunity for people who have a decent sounding degree but aren't getting a lot of fame or attention and want to be in the White House. All you have to do is bend your principles to whatever Trump's are. It literally was my tweet. But I reported on the conversation I had with Priebus. I didn't mention Priebus's name until the book because, you know, why else would someone want to spend money on a book if it was in my tweet? Anyway, so it took them months to find Atlas. And the reason he's not portrayed as a human being is I actually think he's more like the Frankenstein monster. Like, they basically said, we need to create someone who's willing to basically say everything the president believes. And they found the guy. You're right. It turns out he's not an epidemiologist or a virologist or you know, any of those granular details. But he was a radiologist, and he has the name Stanford behind him. And so they brought him into the White House, and he literally parroted everything that Trump wanted him to say. And by the way, he's coming out with a book in November, apparently.
It's a weightlifting book. It's about...
Yes. Sure.
Never mind.
But yes, but there is a section of the book called Atlas Shrugged It Off, which I thought was clever.
Yes, that I got it because that's an Ayn Rand book, Atlas Shrugged.
Like so many different clever connection points. Atlas Shrugged It Off. I stared at that and I said, that's really clever, Andy. You know how many people have recognized that? Zero. Zero people think that's clever besides me.
For the listener, the book does not lack for attempts at cleverness.
I think that is not exactly a compliment, but I am very accepting of it as
no. Occasionally, there are some clever things there, some things that made me go, it's kind of clever.
I mean, I've always been like particularly like very much this pretend amateur jokester in the context.
You at least go out there and try. I mean, most people don't try. And a lot of your tweets have been funny. And you actually went out and did joke baskets on some of your tweets. And I remember there's one where you did 10 jokes, and I went, Jesus Christ, like 8 of these are actually really good.
Yeah.
That day surprised me. We're going to take a little break. We'll be right back with Andy Slavitt, author of Preventable. We're back with Andy Slavitt. So, Trump at the beginning, of course, said that it's all under control. Remember when he was at the CDC? This was one of my favorite moments where he went, it was very early on. He's at the CDC and he says, you know, turns out I'm really good at this stuff and people are surprised. But I have an uncle who is at MIT and I just have a natural talent. And remember that?
Yeah.
And what a weird.
Weird. But you know, the serious point that connects to this is that, like, if you can't separate yourself from the problem, If you see everything as a reflection on you, if your ego is that massive, it got to be crippling to try to solve a problem because you can't even acknowledge it. And that's what he did to us. I mean, in one sentence, that's what he did to us, is he made this about him instead of about us.
He could have made it about him. He could have been, look, who runs for president except for people who are kind of narcissistic? I mean, we've had how many presidents now? This is the 46th?
46th.
I'd say every one of them, you know, Biden ran 3 times for president, right? You're a little narcissistic if you're running for president, and that's fine. But my God, there's a way to, the way to successfully do that is to do some work and do the reading. And, you know, you talk about the transition, and Michael Lewis wrote a book called The Fifth Risk, which is about the Trump transition from Obama to Trump. And you guys, you at CMS, put together all this material for the CMS people to look at. And you're saying that it was kind of an exception because your successor did look at that stuff. But mainly throughout the administration, they just did nothing in the transition. They were just arrogant and stupid.
Yes. And look, by the way, I want to clear this up. I don't think this is a Democrat-Republican thing, either in the transition or in the way this pandemic was handled. I believe wholeheartedly that Mitt Romney would have run both a competent transition and a competent pandemic response. I think George W. Bush would have. I think they would have put good people in place. I think he would have taken it seriously. I think this is about a populist narcissist. And I can't think, I don't know all of the other presidents in our history, but I think that combination is particularly bad, because if you play to the crowd and you don't like delivering bad news and you're divisive and you don't do any planning, that's just really bad juju for making the tough decisions you need to make in a pandemic. And by the way, like showing some empathy, like attending a funeral, like putting the country's flags at half mast, like those are easy things that would have got him like 10 points of popularity. But he literally didn't have any of the empathy to even think to do that, even as a device.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't even think to pretend to have empathy.
Right.
Which is weird.
And then his staff couldn't even
Isn't that weird?
It's weird. And it's even weirder that like his political staff knew him well enough to know that they couldn't even advise him to pretend to have empathy. I mean, it's so pathologic.
And there are some pathological things that, for example, remember, and he did this in front of Burks, and this was the, you know, maybe you can inject a disinfectant into you. And, you know, I have a good instinct for thinking outside the box, and maybe this is good. And so she's enduring this. She's like trying not kind of to look at him and stuff. And then later, my favorite thing about this is he goes like, I was being sarcastic and you know it. And it was like, really? No. What was the sarcastic? What was the sarcastic point?
Yeah.
The sarcastic point is somebody really stupid might say this.
Well, and
I mean, that is, what's the sarcasm?
Right. I mean, granted, he's a master at sarcasm, but, you know, I think it's his he always creates this ability to disown everything he says, because he says things off the cuff, completely spontaneously, without any thought. And he's very confident in his ability to dodge and weave and move and manipulate like he's always done in his career. The problem is when you run into a problem where it's all about perceptions, you know, he's been able to get away with that. But when you run into something like a pandemic, that basically called him out, and it basically showed that he, you know, fundamentally it laid him bare for even people who were, I think, supporters of his to see. Now, they may have still voted for him and for a variety of other reasons, but you know, you had to either believe that he was incompetent or that COVID was a giant farce. You couldn't have believed anything else. I suppose there's some people who believe that every president would have handled this the same way. And, you know, I think those people should look at the book, because I'm not suggesting that anybody would have handled it perfectly, but I am suggesting that there were things over and above heat of the moment, kind of fog of war mistakes, you know, that were basically done purposefully to the American public.
It was almost perfectly wrong at every step of the way. Almost.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about Wuhan. You just mentioned it briefly in the lab, because I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I know, and I was very interested in this. I was on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. I was very interested in diseases that passed from animals to human beings. You know, that's the case in Ebola, right? That's the case in AIDS. That's been the case in a lot of things. And this idea that because the Wuhan laboratory is named a virology laboratory, that they caused it. I mean, they're a virology laboratory because that's where a lot of these coronaviruses come from. So can you shed just some light on this for us?
You know, first of all, I just say some context. The book, it's the way we've been talking about it, sounds like it's a book about Trump or it's a policy book. It's actually mostly not. It's a book about a bunch of characters, people, real people, whose lives tell a great, I think a great way of telling the story of what happened. And one of those characters is the woman who actually explained to President Trump how viruses work and how viruses evolve and they begin. And this is a woman named Blythe Adamson. And the thing we learn about her is that she is trying to find a way to spend the pandemic like the rest of us. And so she's flying to her parents' place in Oregon with her two daughters. She's a woman, a single mom. She's a victim of domestic violence. She has been on medicated public assistance. She's had to sleep in her car. But the other thing about her is she's one of the only people in the country that is both a PhD in epidemiology and a PhD in economics. And so she gets called to the White House. And 2 days later, she walks into the Roosevelt Room and is instantly the smartest person in the room. And she's the person who's in charge of putting together the models that help predict what's going to happen. And the first time she meets President Trump, the president invites a bunch of volunteers into the Oval Office. And he has this little show place thing where it's all males except for her. And they're all young, wealthy people who've made a lot of money. And they're kind of talking about how much money they made. And they come to Blythe. And Blythe introduces herself as a PhD in economics and a PhD in epidemiology, and the president looks at her and says, "The Chinese cooked this up in a lab, didn't they?" And or he said, "You believe the Chinese cooked this up in a lab, right?" And her response, which I think is one of the most genius responses I've ever heard, is, "Mr. President, can I tell you a bedtime story?" And she proceeds to then tell him a bedtime story that mesmerizes him, and it turns out that bedtime story, which is, takes place in a jungle in Africa, and all these characters, turns out is the story of the origin of the AIDS virus. And she explains to him how viruses have all their genealogy tied up in creatures and animals. And so anyway, it sort of goes from there. But the reality of where the virus...
And wasn't that eating meat?
Yes.
On bush meat. Guys building a road or something?
Yeah,
or?
Bush meat. It was good guys who were working on plowing a road through the jungle, started eating bush meat, uncooked bush meat, because they didn't have the time and the ability to do a fire. So that's...
Okay, everybody, don't do that.
Yeah. And you said don't do that to the audience. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, also slightly disrespectful to their intelligence. So here's the kind of thing. Here's what I think about the origin of this. First of all, nobody knows. The intelligence report is written. I've seen the intelligence report. The intelligence report basically is written where 2/3 of people, essentially of the investigators, believe it came from a bat and 1/3 from a lab. None of them had high degrees of confidence. And the way these things are written is they express their level of confidence. So nobody knows. The Chinese are uncooperative. They should be cooperative. There's circumstantial evidence. You could create stories for both. Oh, it's a lab leak. Someone broke a test tube. It aerosolized. Some of the scientists got it, brought it home. You can believe that story. But it would also be a very...
What's this, honey? Oh, damn. That was in my pocket at the lab.
Right.
It's something. Yeah, give it back to me.
It's a Simpsons episode.
Oh, Jimmy, don't... Oh, don't play with the test. Oh, right. Now it's all...
Could be either. But here's kind of one of the points I want to make here on your show is that people are asking the question, why did nobody believe Trump when he said, hey, this thing probably came from a lab? And tell me if you agree with my conclusion here. My conclusion is that if you lie all the time, people will think you're a liar. And if you're someone who lies, points fingers, avoids blame, makes stuff up, improvises, then when you say something, people aren't going to believe it. That's just a byproduct of being a liar.
But a stopped clock is right twice a day. But then again, a clock that's working that is 8.5 hours off is just wrong all the time. Clearly the idea, but there are people who believe every word he says because they've decided that's what they're going to do.
He said that he didn't know. He had no idea. I mean, he said it as a deflection. Maybe he believed it, but he didn't see any intelligence reports which told him it was true. It is possible, but it was not said because he had some great insight. It was said because he wanted to basically make the point that this is a China virus. It's their fault. Everybody who dies in this country is not on me.
And you know, now he takes credit for stopping flights from China. You have a statistic about how many people had flown from China to the United States before that ban. What had that been? And also, he wasn't banning Americans coming back, right?
Yeah, and he wasn't banning travel from Europe. But it was his one go-to action. It wasn't a very effective action. But the entirety of the task force was not focused on PPE. It was not focused on testing. It was focused on one thing: how to bring Americans back from China. And they did that. They brought a lot of Americans back home from China. And then they banned travel. And to be quite honest, Hong Kong, which is a little closer to China than we are, didn't ban travel. And as of 9 months into the pandemic, only had 100 deaths. So there's not a logical conclusion to say that this was a bold winning move on Trump's part, or even an effective move on Trump's part. But you know, when he came down to saying, well, what have you actually done? There's really only one thing he could point to.
Yeah, but he did do that, and he did get some criticism at the time for it. But
whatever the cause, our president's first obligation is to protect the public and protect health of the public. Whether this was a Chernobyl or Three Mile Island or a Pearl Harbor bombing or a 9/11 or cooked in a lab or came from a bat, doesn't matter. His obligation is exactly the same. And I believe what he was telling the country was, folks, this is not on me. This is on China. It's the China virus. And you can't blame me for it.
Well, you know, I really, really enjoyed reading this book because it was, it gave me a lot of insight and stuff we haven't talked about that really jumped out at me. That I just encourage people to give this close read, actually, in terms of just what happened, to know what happened. And Andy was not just close to it in the 4 months that he was in the Biden administration, but preceding that did a tremendous amount working on the inside to get things done, including working with the people in the Trump administration. I admire what you've done and what you did and what I assume you'll continue to do in this space and in others, including trying to get to universal health care, which is the United States of Care, is their goal, the organization you created. Thanks for doing this, Andy, again.
Thank you for having me. Always great to connect.
It is always fun.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.